This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send in your question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, how are you guys doing this evening?
Yeah, we're good. How are you, Nate?
All's well.
Well, we've got a bit of lots of questions today that both of you guys are going to try to answer and that you are going to answer. And so we'll just take them one by one. And as soon as we're done with all these, I think, you know, a list of less than 10 questions, then we will conclude the show. So without further ado, dear Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, what are your thoughts on group therapy? What is the purpose, if there is one, and how would you apply evolutionary principles and esteem dynamics to such a session?
Wow. Well, I'm going to let Doug start on that one since he has more practical experience actually leading group therapy sessions and just has a little more wisdom probably to share on this than I do.
Yeah, except that I'm an old man now and I'm practically senile. So it's been 30 years since I did any group therapy for a reason. And that's that I think it's generally worthless. There was a time in way back in the day in the 60s and 70s where group therapy was suspected as being this great thing. And there's a character by the name of Irving Yalom who wrote a classic work that was the classic of the field, talking all about how essentially, I don't know what it says in the book because nobody ever read it. It was just one of these tomes that you were supposed to know about. So I'm reporting now that I do, in fact, know about the book. All right. But Yalom's concept was that he was going to be put all the therapists out of business because group therapy, you know, obviously you can do 10 people at a time and therefore it's a lot less expensive and people can treat themselves and all this sort of jazz. Now, let's back the camera up for a second and try to understand what in fact therapy is. So I don't buy the notion that therapy is going back into childhood hurts, talking all about them, and then somehow getting remothered by your therapist. Okay, so this is the basic concept of dynamic therapy, and I think it's fundamentally wrong. In fact, I don't think it's fundamentally wrong. I know it's wrong. So now we're going to, group therapy has that aspect to it. It's as if we're like little wounded souls and we're going to get together and talk about our little wounds. Now, there's some interesting things that can happen in there, but let's talk about fundamentally what I believe, quote, therapy is. Therapy is not in principle any different than any other experience in your life. All it is new information. And so new information, if it's going to be useful, we would say new ideas, not new information, because the new ideas can definitely be wrong. And so if the new ideas are wrong and you buy it, then you're more distorted and messed up than you were when you started, which is what I believe happens consistently in psychodynamic psychotherapy. And so there's a very psychodynamic slant in most group therapy procedures. And so therefore, I think it's basically a little cesspool of psychodynamic thinking from you know, marginally therapy-wise educated, half-educated human beings, that including the leader who doesn't know anything. Okay, so this is the blind leading the blind through the psychodynamic morass and coming out the other end probably not too much the worse for wear. Now, but no better. It's very unlikely that any good has been accomplished. That's because the entire way of thinking about the problem is wrong. What we've got is we've got distortions inside the person's thinking in very important competitive arenas. That's why they're suffering. And what they need is they need expert guidance and feedback in order to sharpen their ability to understand reality and start attacking the problems from a way that will lead to their superior achievement in those domains and therefore reduce the discrepancy between the experiences they're having now and what they think they should be having, which is that discrepancy is what's causing their psychological angst. So group therapy, I think, is, in other words, it's, you know, don't try to get your science from People magazine. In other words, this is just a bunch of people talking isn't going to get you more accurate. In principle, if the idiot next to you is 10% smarter than you, then you could benefit from talking to the person. Okay, but God help you if you're the most competent, most together person in a group therapy room, you're going to get nothing but garbage, and you're better off keeping your own counsel. So that's what I think about esteem dynamics, group therapy, and all that.
Now, Dr. Hawk, this seems like this would be right in your wheelhouse, because in such a group therapy session, people could be competing for who has the best trauma in order to get status from the group leader.
Oh, I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen not only in my own group therapy experiences. So I, as a more open human than Dr. Lyle, I've subjected myself to all kinds of psychodynamic crap over the years, including all sorts of group therapy settings, including group therapy settings of all kinds of misguided, mystical, let's rebirth ourselves and let's, you know, remember our past lives together and channel from higher sources from other realms and just all of this crap. So yeah, there is unbelievable trauma mongering that goes on. There's my history is worse than your history. I'm more damaged than you are. I have more wisdom on this problem because I'm more damaged than you are. It's a bizarre little hyper competitive realm that is mimicking just the exact kind of competitive distortion that you need to get away from in order to solve the real competitive problems that have brought you to therapy. So, this is a really confusing environment for most people unless they really know themselves very well and they know where they need to go. But I have a sign above my desk that says that reminds me when I'm coaching people that just says therapy is learning. It's learning. It's new ideas, new information, like Doug is saying, and that information and those ideas can just as easily be really bad as they can be really helpful. So you need to be discerning about who you're putting yourself in the path of as a teacher and as a coach. So, generally a bad idea.
But and you could get these, laid, though.
Oh, my God. This is actually what I was going to say. It was one of the other extensive group therapy experiences I've had is in 12-step, of course, which considers itself a form of group therapy. I went to one meeting where they said, you know, it's the God of your own understanding, and God just could stand for group of drunks. And so they all considered themselves like the advisors. And there's a joke in 12-step that people engage in what we call 13th stepping, which is that they've worked the steps and now they're super fancy and they know more about this problem than the newcomers, and they're going to guide them very personally and, you know, they think so. Try to get laid in the process. So yeah, you've got all kinds of shenanigans in group therapy situations, and I've just never seen them be more beneficial than working one-on-one with a good therapist who actually is committed to the process of de-distorting you, not making you more distorted and more confused. And protecting their own, lining their own pockets with rewarding your trauma process.
So when people are competing for who has the most trauma, I guess you wouldn't call them one-upping each other. They'd be calling one-downing each other.
Yeah, I call it in my dissertation and elsewhere, it's a race to the bottom. It really is. It's how, you know, how much can we be competitive and how much we've suffered.
Wow. All right, well, our next question. Dear doctors, help me beat my genes. My mother-in-law treats her four grandchildren, all within 1 year of each other, quite differently. And I understand why, but I could benefit from learning more information. Two of the grandchildren are from her daughter, and the other two from her sons. While I know she favors her daughter's girls more because they represent genetic certainty, I'm a disagreeable person who really values fairness. It's hard not to comment or approach her when she treats them so differently. Let's not even begin to get into how many more clothes and toys and resources overall she gets for her daughter's girls. It also doesn't help that she believes that my daughter looks nothing like her son. Humorously, I have even sent her pictures of my daughter and my husband at the same age to point out the similarities, and she still refuses to see it. Is there a way for her to look at my daughter differently and allocate resources fairly?
Well, I think this is... It just seems like a good one for you.
you're giving me the fun ones. I mean, this is what we sometimes would refer to as the Plomian curse. This is a personality problem first and foremost. I mean, she's suggesting that the fairness is misallocated and that the preferences are a direct function of genetic certainty. And there's some of that going on, but really what's driving preferences for anybody, whether it's grandchildren or partners or coworkers or anybody, is personality compatibility. And so this is, there's really nothing to be done here. The preference is going to be the preference. She's going to get along better with certain grandchildren, certain children than others. This is being driven by personality first and foremost. And then the other piece of this is that she doesn't, this fairness chip that you have, this idea that, you know, your daughter-in-law needs to treat everyone equally is completely misguided. Nobody needs to treat anybody any way at all. Nobody owes anybody anything. And, you know, the extent to which we can demand equality of conditions from anybody else who is not our sovereign self is always a bad idea. And it's being distorted through disagreeableness in this instance. So I don't think there's much to do here. There's certainly no special sauce in rewiring your thoughts or learning to love someone more than someone else, and it's all coming down to personality and the Plomin curse.
Wow.
Yeah. Sorry.
No, that's great, because I can imagine you have a lot of people who get into these problems and they're finding out, they're trying to be crafty and try to change it in some way, and you're saying, no, that's not really going to be possible, to the extent that it's going to make anybody happy.
No, not really. Certainly not in a family dynamic like this. You know, sometimes you can have this sort of an inherent preference for one coworker over another coworker, and you just like them better, and that's just because you have better personality resonance, and that might be shifted. The CB on that could shift if the deal with a different coworker becomes a better deal, but that's not going to happen with grandchildren. So this is just the way it is, and let's just accept that not everybody's going to be treated fair. Doug is doing a meditative pose.
Who's the hippie now? So just to unwind this a little bit more, to what extent could this be potentially from something the daughter said to her a long time ago, and now she's pent up a grudge or something like that? And should she essentially have a state of the union about this?
It's not going to make much of a difference. I mean, disagreeable people are going to be more prone to holding grudges in general. So yes, it could have been, you know, initiated by that process, but that was really just the getting to know you process, which would have unfolded the same way no matter whether that thing had been said that day or not. And if they have a state of the union, there might be a momentary peace in the kingdom, but it's going to last 3.5 minutes before there's some other insult that happens at the next holiday gathering, and it's all just back into the mud once more. So this is the state of affairs, and family dynamics are just as stable as any other relationship dynamics.
So I got a larger question then. Is an ideal relationship, whether it's with a friend, potential mate, family member, is an ideal relationship one where it's essentially very easy, then there's virtually no major conflicts?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That's that is the secret of life.
the secret of life
is to control your environment, and your environment is primarily the people that you spend your time with. That is what the environment is. You know, certain other things factor into it, but mostly it's the people that you're spending most of your time with, and absolutely just coming to terms with the fact that they are not going to change. They are who they are. It is we call it Groundhog Day. It's Groundhog Day. It's relationships are very stable equilibria of stable personality characteristics, that it's just this, it's going to be the same pattern over and over and over and over again. And so choose your groundhogs, you know, don't be friends with nasty, feral, grudge holding groundhogs. go for the sweet little cuddly ones like you want to hang out with, because that is your environment, and your environment is your life experience.
Mm-hmm. And for people, you know, I've heard all my life, oh, relationships require lots of work, and we had to work a lot to get this relationship to where it is.
No.
Thank you.
No, this is complete. This is all that does is drive many a self-help industry and line the pockets of many therapists who want you to come back into their office and pay them more money so you can continue to work on your communication and work on your marriage. Like, no, this is obviously there can be conflicts of interest. There can be situations where external circumstances have stressed people out, and there really is something to work through, but you're working through it in a united front to solve a problem. You're not pitched against each other like that. The, you know, question we had last week with the fellow and his ex-wife with the kids on the roof that were spying on the neighbor, that was never a good groundhog. You know, that relationship, they didn't have to work on anything. That was, they never had communication problems. The communication was always very clear. The priorities of each of the people in that relationship were always very clear. They just didn't necessarily like them very much, and they fought about them for a long time, and then they finally decided to divorce, much to the benefit of each of them. So these things are, this writing is on the wall with any relationship very early on. You know, there have been many observers of human nature over the eons who have said things like, when people show you who they are, believe them, or, you know, people really tell you who they are. And it's really true. The groundhogs reveal themselves early and often and consistently and unwaveringly.
It seems to me that this whole explanation about it takes work is also a manipulation strategy of disagreeable people, that, oh, if you don't stick by me because I'm a disagreeable person, then you therefore aren't a hard enough worker, you're not conscientious enough, etc.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Very good thinking.
Yeah, very good thinking. Yeah, it can absolutely be a way to keep people hooked into a relationship for expedient reasons, and to continue manipulating and exploiting a nice agreeable.
Absolutely.
An agreeable, especially if that agreeable is conscientious. They're told that they need to work on something to make it better, and they're going to be like, well, oh my gosh, I need to work on it. I need to devote myself wholeheartedly to fixing this because this person's upset, instead of actually taking this relationship on its own terms. And and, you know, this question started with, you know, grandchildren and daughters-in-law and family, and it really just applies whether it's kind of chosen family or not. There's no difference. Just because you happen to be related to someone or you have someone marry into the family, we are all individuals, and we are all our own groundhogs.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Fabulous.
Do you have anything else to add to that now that I've steamrolled the question?
No, it's great.
Disagreeable person that I am. these kind of questions make me disagreeable.
Well, obviously you have to work on something.
That's right. Yeah.
All right. Dr. Lau, did you want to add anything?
No, that's good. That's all right. Go forward.
All right. Okay. I am an avid listener over here in the UK. Recently, you described the Enlightenment trap, which interests me greatly, and I wondered if you believe that there was some degree to which meditation practice was a means of beating the genetic disposition for egoistic drives for status enhancement. Robert Wright certainly seems to think so. I recognize that there are apparently many examples of pseudo-meditators displaying their practice conspicuously as a sort of status or virtue signaling attempt. But do you believe there are some devotees who genuinely manage to reduce their egoistic drives? I'm a theater maker working on a show called Buddhism, Is It Just for Losers? So your thoughts on this topic would be very helpful.
This is beautiful. This is a great question for Jen. She spent a lot of time in this sort of arena. And so, this is the last couple of years has been the time when you sort of reformulating a lot of your thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, good. Mm-hmm. This will be entertaining.
Yeah, well, I did. Yeah, I spent many, many years in various faces of the Enlightenment trap. So the question is interesting because the questioner seems to understand at a fundamental level what the Enlightenment trap really is about. But then this sort of follow-up of, are some meditators successfully silencing the ego or destroying the egoic drive? Like that is what the Enlightenment trap is doing, is this idea that this pretension that we could get away with this notion that we're not driven by the ego. All we're driven by is what we would call the ego. You can't turn it on or turn it off depending on how diligent your meditation practice is. There's no escaping the competitive reality of your life on planet Earth. That is what you are here to do, is to survive and to reproduce and to secure all the spoils along the way that you were possibly capable of doing. And this idea that we can somehow, if we just have the right program, or we just pay enough attention, or we go into silent retreat just long enough and we really turn off that drive, that we could do it. Nobody can do it. People vary in their ability to bluff that they're able to do it, but nobody can actually escape the absolute compulsion that the ego, like there's no other point to human life. There's no other point to life on Earth in general. So anybody who I want to know more about Buddhism. Is it just for losers? Because it sounds like this questioner is working through a few of these different conflicts and watching a lot of this in action. And it's very tempting because, you know, you can get into, you're again, like with the group therapy question, when you're surrounded by people who are drinking the same Kool-Aid that you are, and you're all talking about how you've transcended your ego, ironically, in somewhat of a competitive way. I've transcended more ego than I'm even less attached to my outcomes than you are. This is what happens. It's totally what happens. I've seen it a million times. And so there's no escape. It is a competitive rumble from start to finish. Hobbes was right. Life is nasty, brutish, and short. there's no escape. And all we can do is kind of come to terms with where we are and maximize our enjoyment of the process by controlling our environment as much as we can. And, you know, living life according to really the serenity prayer and surrendering this idea that we have any control over the things that we can't control. And the primary thing that we can't control is the fact that life is inherently competitive, whether you're in the Enlightenment trap or not.
And what you're saying, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk, is that the only thing we really can control is our environment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's empowering.
Choose your people.
Yeah.
All right. Dr. Lyle, do you have a comment?
No, that's good. Right on target.
He's just letting me ramble today.
Yeah, no, that's excellent.
Fantastic. We love it. Well, Dr. Hawk, I don't know if you know, but last week we got through two questions. one was 40 minutes and one was like 25 minutes. So.
Yes, well, the great guru, once he gets started. I always feel that, you know, the podcast, I mean, some of these questions are, it's occasionally worth really backing up and going from zero with some of these, but a lot of listeners are already pretty schooled up, so we can kind of start at the grad school level and just jump right into these things.
So. Well, I'm a kindergartner, so please don't skip it over. All right. Dear Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, I'm a professional woman in my middle years, and I'd like to be less critical of people and other things. I grew up in a home where both parents criticized me, my siblings, each other, and everyone else, except not themselves, all the time. With my father, the object of criticism seemed to be whoever was out of the room at the time. My mother was just openly critical. When I was part of those one-on-one conversations with my father, I actually felt closer to him, even though I know he criticized me behind my back too. It was as though he trusted me enough to share his real opinion about someone. I still sometimes feel that way when someone badmouths someone else to me. Other contributing factors are that I'm a very analytical person who is not a pleaser by nature. However, I'm not extremely disagreeable, and I'm in a job where I need to be critical and at times adversarial to succeed. I've noticed that many people, especially those living on the West Coast, are turned off by criticism and complaining. I know that I sometimes have the same reaction to people who are extremely critical, too. I don't want to be cheerful in a phony way or be naively optimistic. And I recognize that for anything to improve, one has to take a hard look at a situation to accurately evaluate it. But I want to be more accepting of people and situations, or at least more guarded, so that people are not put off by what I say or what I think.
Well, I think Dr. Lyle is really the expert on this one. I'm gonna punt this over to him. This sounds like a personality problem that would be fit only for Dr. Lyle's analysis.
Once again, what we see is the theory that we're going to change. And so, so we don't see the concept here of how am I going to change my environmental circumstances and therefore improve my existence. What we see is the question of how can I change me so that I can improve my functioning within the environment. So once again, we come back to personality, which is, we might call it the Plowman Pinata. Everybody's born with a Plowman Pinata, and when you break that thing open,
you don't know what's in there. Could be really good candy, could be really bad candy,
and whatever it is, it's coming out. So
could be raisins.
Yeah. So the bottom line is here: this person, obviously, as we hear her describe her upbringing. And the parents, it sounds like there's a lot of disagreeability in the gene pool. Sounds like the apple didn't fall too far from the tree. Not obviously high functioning, highly intelligent, and doing fine in the world, but certainly finds that not too far away from her consciousness is a lot of criticism for other people. This is because the way you think and thereby the way you feel and thereby the way you act are all emanating from the genetic code. So you don't choose what you think. Your genes dictate what you think. So your thoughts are literally derivatives of the deep algorithm judgments that are built by gene variances. And so, the basic genetic code builds the species vision of what it needs to value and in what way. And then individual differences in how the genes put together, the different sort of colors of the bricks and the different nature of the proteins that can build those circuits, those give rise to variances. And those variances are what we see, like everybody has the ability to be critical of other people. Everyone does. Right. But the question is, how much critical sauce got put in your soup?
In your pinata.
That's in your pinata, okay? And so this person has a lot of criticism in her pinata. That just is the way it is. It's always going to be that way. And it sounds like she's managed it very well, not managed to get tossed out of jobs and excommunicated from everybody. But your possibility of changing you is zero. Okay? And so, if you want to figure out how to act nicer and maybe get away with that, take an acting class. That might be useful.
Go to group therapy.
Go to group therapy. There you go. But no, that's the name of the game. We are each and every one of us a Plowman special, and that's just what you are. That's how it works.
Mm-hmm. So for people who are not happy in their lives, it could be that their personality is distorted or that they're not being competitive in particular arenas, right?
Well, yeah, unhappiness is going to be the result of a frustration when the self has analyzed where it believes it, what it should be getting from reality, and it notices a discrepancy from what it thinks it should be getting versus what it is getting. And so that can come from very pleasant, nice, talented, intelligent people that have not yet obtained competitive stripes or competitive feedback in the esteemed domains so that they're unhappy. Mm-hmm. So I've been unhappy many times in my life, usually short-lived, but not always. And so, and what that unhappiness does is that's a signaling device to tell me that there's a discrepancy between what part, one part of the brain, its analytic chip is telling me that I should be able to do better than I'm doing. And that then, that discomfort or unpleasantness or depression or feeling of rejection or frustration or anger or jealousy or envy, those feelings are feelings that are signaling devices to orient me to the apparent fact that there is time and energy that should be invested in improving my competitive standing in that domain, and it's likely that that time and energy will be rewarded with increased likelihood of success that's associated with gene survival increases. That's how the system is built, okay? But if someone is chronically unhappy and irritated...
Got a bad pinata. It's a pinata full of rotten fruit.
That's what it is. It's its own Plowman special.
And this is so. I mean, we harp on this endlessly because it's really profoundly liberating. Like it sounds kind of depressing and fatalistic, and it is kind of fatalistic and depressing. But it's also very liberating because if the secret, most of these enlightenment traditions are telling you, you know, the secret of enlightenment is to not take things personally. That's kind of the objective of all these meditators sitting on their cushions at all these retreat centers. But really the only way I've ever found to not take things personally is not sitting on a cushion watching my thoughts or trying to get closer to God. It's actually realizing that everyone's plum and special. Everyone's got their little pinata, and that is how they are. And I'm sort of incidental to their life experience. And they're responding to me. I am modular. I could be anybody. They're just responding in a predictable way based on their personality. And likewise, me too. So it's very empowering and liberating.
Yeah. I mean, the whole notion of enlightenment as it's woven through this discussion tonight is the notion of enlightenment is that you transcend the need to get esteem. Mm-hmm. And so it's the notion of you're sitting on your cushion and you don't care what anybody else thinks and it's just you and the universe. This is actually fundamentally wrong. That's a bluff.
Totally.
The truth of the matter is that the secret of life is in the esteem dynamics between us and other people that we love. That's actually the secret of life. The secret of life is to have a life that is integrated with people that we really, that because of who they are and who we are, the interaction results in joy. That is the secret of life. So the secret of life is absolutely is about being high degree of discriminating taste and rejection of people.
Ruthless degree of discernment and rejection, really.
Yes.
The more ruthless you can be, the happier you can be, the greater the potential.
Yes.
Yeah.
There you go.
Fascinating. I'm just glad it only took us 192 episodes to get to the secret of life.
Well, we can just shut it down.
Yeah. Tell your mother-in-law goodbye. That begins tonight.
Yeah. Your mother-in-law, your boss, you're like whoever it needs to be. Like no. this really is your environment is the people.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. All right. Well, we have a few more questions, but it's probably going to be a little lightning round, so some quicker answers. So just feel free to shout out the answer right when you know it.
All right.
Oh, do we have buzzers?
Here we go.
Okay.
All right. For us dating seniors, do basic dynamics of romantic attraction remain even though no childbearing potential exists?
Yes.
Yes.
All right, moving on. Could a lack of desire for producing offspring lead to apathy toward accumulating resources and achievements?
Yes.
Yes. Hold on, I got a story to tell.
Yeah, so, we got a story.
So I got our friend Larry.
Oh, God. our mobster.
Our mobster friend Larry.
The Italian Jewish mobster.
Right, he was an Italian Jewish mobster who's very married to a lovely lady. And
really.
And actually, you had dinner with him tonight
I
by
did,
chance.
Yes.
Yeah. So you got a nice dose of Larry.
I got a dose of the mobster up close and personal.
And he and I had a conversation about 20 years ago where I was, for the first time, for some reason, I was contemplating the possibility of not having children. It was really the first time that that somehow it dawned on me, like I was just starting to do well financially, and I was wrestling over the notion of you know, how expensive it would be to have children here in Sonoma County area. It's expensive land. And so I was talking to Larry and Cheryl, and I was out in their driveway. Larry, by the way, he's about 10 years older than I am, so he's senior to me. So he's a little bit like a big brother, a big, tough, nasty brother that'll get everybody on the phone and get your money back. So I was talking to them, and they had decided not to have children. And I said, you know, I'm just getting this idea that, you know, maybe, you know, if I didn't have children, I'd have all this money for myself. And Larry looks at me and goes, yeah. Like, what?
Yeah.
So
don't need to squirrel away quite as much.
There you go. Yeah. So anyway, the answer to the question is yes.
Yes, absolutely. Of course, it's all CB. It's all right. Like, what do you need the money for? If you don't need the money to provision a clan, then you need less, depending on your particularities.
Leave the office early.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely.
Right.
Totally. Yeah. And thereby, and if you obviously you have offspring, it has its own joys. I call.
Right.
Having
Apparently,
kids,
it's kind of cool.
Yeah, I call it going to Rome. There's nothing like Rome,
right?
But if you don't go to Rome, then you get to visit a bunch of other places. So it's a trade off, and that's just what it is. But there's certainly an upside, and one of them is that you don't have to be quite so ambitious and quite so conscientious, and you can be a little more self indulgent, and that is true.
Sounds good to me.
Don't signal that to your potential parabons, Horace.
All right. What else we got?
All right. Speaking of parabons, why is it that men seem to get very uncomfortable discussing women's health issues or genitalia, but women apparently don't feel uncomfortable discussing men's?
Boy, I'm uncomfortable with the question, so I'm going to give that to Jen.
This is the advantage of recording in the same place, so this spontaneous like handoff. We sometimes get questions on the podcast that are reflective of just a little bit of distorted experience. I don't think that is universally true at all. I think you could find plenty of evidence to the contrary on both sides of that equation, and this questioner is just having a distorted sample experience where they're around people who exhibit, you know, discomfort in one direction or another. But I don't think there's any evolutionary psychology reason behind it, because I don't think it would be a consistent finding if we looked across the population. It would all balance out.
Mm-hmm. And from my understanding too, anybody who's disagreeable, women or male or female, wouldn't have a lot of discomfort around discussing things like this.
Yeah, it could be. It's going to interact with openness, and particularly sexual openness. And but yeah, that disagreeable willingness to kind of push the envelope and make people uncomfortable is going to drive a lot of that. So,
yeah. All right. What else do we have?
All right. Our final question. Why aren't more girls choosing to pursue careers in math and science? Open up a big can over here.
Yeah,
oh no,
big can.
This is good. So I get to, yeah, Jen. Jen is a woman that used to be a girl and is a scientist. So now we'll turn that over to her.
This impeccable logic. This is interesting, because this is there's actually been a lot of research done into this question in Scandinavia in particular, because it does seem like a little bit of a puzzle. This is what social scientists love to look at, puzzles. You know, what explains this sort of seemingly paradoxical result? And these Scandinavian studies, what they've done is that they've realized, after tackling this from many directions and replicating it many times, this is some of the most robust work done in social science, is that, you know, if someone's someone's interests, someone's career interests, if we can say that, you know, to a large degree, their career interest is determined by personality, by their plum and pinata, and that there's some degree of their interest that's being directed by what we could broadly call the environment. So, you know, the kind of school they went to, or the socioeconomic circumstances that they are growing up in. And so what happens especially in Scandinavia, you've essentially controlled for the environment. You've made the environment, all that socioeconomic status and all of that access, essentially equal across the population. And so all that's left to drive preferences is personality. So you see this paradoxical result where it actually maximizes the differences in personality. And women are, very broadly speaking, more interested in people, and men are more interested in things. And so that's going to translate into STEM careers, math, science careers. You're just going to have more innate interest among men when you've controlled for these, for the fact that women would otherwise be looking at that career as a way to equalize their income, but now there are plenty of other ways to do so because they're facing equality of circumstance socially and economically. So the more equal you make things, essentially, the more you concentrate personality differences, and that applies to career choices and everything else.
This appears to be such a controversial opinion. Like, this makes perfect sense to me, but I constantly read articles and discuss things with people. Maybe it's because we're in California, but that they say, oh no, that's not true. Women and men are fundamentally not different.
Yeah, but people don't like to think about inherent gender differences. They don't like to think about an inherent gender binary. They don't like to think about a lot of these things. But this is where the evidence points us, that on balance, of course, just like anything else, when you're talking about population bell curves like this, this says nothing about any given individual. So any given individual female could have just as much of a rage to master, passionate interest in a STEM career, and just as much interest in things and calculations and that sort of impulse as the assumption of the male population on average. It says nothing about individuals. All it does is describe averages across populations. But across the population of males versus females, there are differences. There are significant differences in a lot of areas, and this is one of them.
Yeah, how could there not be?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's women come into the world with a innately massively increased investment in offspring.
Mm-hmm.
So you would expect women to be massively more interested in babies,
mm-hmm.
which they are.
Mm-hmm.
They're way more interested in young children.
On average, early
childhood
more.
Education. There's no comparison.
Yeah.
Okay. So men are way more interested in warfare derivative things,
mm-hmm.
you know, football, baseball, basketball, wrestling, boxing, kickboxing, mm-hmm. MMA. There's no end to it.
Pardon me while I take a nap.
Hockey.
This has suddenly gotten super boring. I need to go check on my dogs.
Yeah. So there you have it. There you go. There you go. You got it.
Well, you know, I just love how much we've covered in these last almost 4 years, because I remember we really were very carefully going over this 4 years ago. And now it's just like we're just saying it and people can choke it down.
Right. By the way, Jen informs me that her genes are somehow inside of her dogs.
They
She's
are.
Just sure that they're in there.
Absolutely. I don't doubt it for you. I don't
from
remember.
The past life.
Yes, yes.
Oh God.
I actually had a psychic tell me when I got my dog Motown, who I've had for, you know, nearly 11 years, so that was how long ago I talked to the psychic, just to contextualize my woo-woo history. It was a while ago, people. She told me that Motown and I had shared every single one of my past lifetimes. He'd played a role in every single past lifetime,
yeah.
So he was a very important spirit guide on my journey. So,
yes.
So that was why I felt so close to him.
Yes.
Not because my genes were in him, which is clearly the truth.
Good karma.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
All right. Fantastic. Well, we're done with the lightning round, and it's a pleasure to have you both on, as always. And we will look forward to talking with you both at a future show.
Great.
It's always a delight.
Thank you, Nathan.
Thanks, Nathan.
All right. Have a good night. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.com.
www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.